Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Aloha, namaste, and assalamu alaikum, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York City. I'm John Heilman, in again for Nicole Wallace this week. It's exactly 1 week ago, at this very hour, FBI agents were on the ground of Donald Trump's South Florida private club and residence, Mar-a-Lago, conducting the unprecedented historic search and seizure operation that yielded a trove of classified documents, some classified as high as top secret, and setting off a chain of events with profound legal and political implications for Donald Trump, the Republican Party, and perhaps America. Today, amid mounting concerns about political violence and a steady drip of details about the Department of Justice probe into Trump's handling of all that sensitive information, the political firestorm ignited by the search shows no sign of dying out. Let's start with the disgraced, twice impeached, coup staging, pathologically duplicitous former president who in just the past few hours posted on his rather ironically named Truth Social platform that his passports were seized by the FBI. There's one big caveat to that. NBC News has not independently verified if the claim is true. But if it is, it could be yet another potentially significant detail in what has become a stream of revelations. The Washington Post out with new details on the early stages of the probe when officials at the National Archives suspected that Trump still had documents in his possession even after they retrieved 15 boxes from Mar-a-Lago. Quote, "At first, archives officials believed that the FBI wasn't taking the documents issue seriously, and they grew frustrated, according to people familiar with the document dispute. But agents had interviewed Trump's current and former advisors, asking them how the boxes taken to Mar-a-Lago were packed, what material was in them, who was responsible for the packing, and what might still be at the Florida Club, according to a person who was questioned. Quote, "They interviewed almost everyone who worked for him," a Trump advisor said. And the New York Times, out with another significant new detail that could help explain why the DOJ, led by the famously cautious and careful by the book Merrick Garland, would have opted for this unprecedented, potentially historic step of asking for a search warrant of an ex-president's private home. Quote, "At least one lawyer for former President Donald J. Trump signed a written statement in June asserting that all material marked as classified and held in boxes in a storage area and Mr. Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence and club had been returned to the government. The written declaration was made after a visit on June 3rd to Mar-a-Lago by Jay Bratt, the top counterintelligence official of the Justice Department's National Security Division." That statement, not true, obviously, and a kind of a big problem for whatever lawyer signed it. The New York Times also reports that a Trump ally had reached out to the DOJ, quote, "Mr. Trump wanted Mr. Garland to know that he'd been checking in with people around the country and found them being enraged by the search." Of course, it's Donald Trump and his allies who fanned the flames, and threats against the FBI and law enforcement have spiked in the wake of the raid, leading the FBI and Department of Homeland Security to issue a joint bulletin. According to CBS News, it reads in part, quote, "The FBI and DHS have observed an increase in violent threats posted on social media against federal officials and facilities, including a threat to place a so-called dirty bomb in front of FBI headquarters and issuing general calls for civil war and armed rebellion. The FBI and DHS have identified multiple articulated threats and calls for the targeted killing of judicial, law enforcement, and government officials associated with the Palm Beach search. The FBI and DHS have also observed the personal identifying information of possible targets of violence, such as home addresses and identification of family members, disseminated online as additional targets." Joining us now, Jackie Alemany, Washington Post congressional investigations reporter. Also, Frank Figluzzi, former FBI assistant director for counterintelligence and now the host of the Bureau podcast. And the man, the myth, the legend, former CIA director John Brennan is with us. They are all MSNBC contributors. And Director Brennan, we will get to you. We have a lot of questions that I want to get to with you. I missed you all last week and was dying to know what you had to say. But I want to start with Jackie Alemany because, Jackie, you're all over this story. And as it was last week, things were moved fast last week. They're still moving fast. Tell us what you know in terms of where the story is headed right now.
Yeah, John, well, we're still trying to answer the question that everyone else is trying to answer, which is what exactly did the FBI ultimately seize from the premises of Mar-a-Lago and the former president's residence? As the search warrant that was provided on Friday indicated, agents were seeking evidence of three potential violations of federal statutes, a section including a section of the Espionage Act, which makes it a crime to possess or share national defense secrets without authorization, and a law against stealing, destroying, or mutilating government records. But aside from figuring out what they were potentially investigating, now we are trying to nail down what exactly they obtained in that search and what aggravated the situation so much as to force the FBI to rise to the level of having to execute a search warrant. We have just learned that Kash Patel is visiting the former president at Bedminster today, presumably to discuss the defense that he has put forward over the course of the weekend, which is that these items were all declassified because he declared that so, which is not how it works. But some experts are saying that that defense could potentially at least provide some sort of temporary boost to the former president if this does continue to escalate the way it has. And he claims that a lot of these documents he was trying to declassify.
John Brennan, I said I'd come to you, I want to get you now, just because again we're gonna have you for the whole hour. But I want to start this. I think I've not heard you speak on this matter. Maybe you have somewhere, but of the whole thing, I think you maybe been off last week. Damn you! Let's put up this timeline of what happened here in this investigation, just to remind people of the probe into Trump's mishandling of classified documents. We start in January of this year, the National Archives retrieving those 15 boxes of documents from Mar-a-Lago. In February, the archives asked the DOJ to investigate because they don't think everything's there. Into the spring of 2022, this year, the DOJ subpoenas Trump. On June 3rd, the FBI senior DOJ officials meet with lawyers at Mar-a-Lago. Trump is present. On June 8th, the DOJ asked for a second lock on a storage room door. In June of 2022, also same month, Trump lawyer signs this statement, according to the New York Times, saying no more classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. June 22nd, DOJ subpoenas Trump Organization for surveillance footage, the surveillance footage that Donald Trump used to watch the entire search, which he said was going on behind closed doors. We learned that last week. And then on August 8th, the FBI searching Mar-a-Lago. That's a timeline put together from every credible news source we have. So, Director Brennan, just give me your top line here on what you've seen unfold over the last week, how you think Merrick Garland is handling this, how you think it is, what you think is animating it, and do you think they're doing this job the right way?
Well, John, it certainly seems as though the Department of Justice, Merrick Garland, have been very careful in terms of how they've gone about trying to retrieve these documents that should not be in the possession of Donald Trump. As your chronology indicates, there have been back and forth between the folks in the Trump orbit and the Department of Justice National Archives. But it's clear that over the course of 20 months, these very sensitive documents, 11 sets of classified documents, as well as other sets of documents or material that shouldn't be in his private possession down at Mar-a-Lago, that these documents are something that I think were intentionally withheld from the government. It's not as though it was just a couple of documents that might have been mixed in with other things. But there seems to be some type of effort on the part, not just of Donald Trump, but also others to try to conceal the fact that he was retaining these documents. And so when I look at some of the labels that the Department of Justice now has said were on these documents, top secret, SCI, secret documents and others, it's really quite concerning because who knows who might have had access to these documents over the course of these last 20 months. And so therefore, I think the Department of Justice, working with the FBI and the intelligence community, wanted to retrieve these documents. I think that was their first and foremost objective, to try to regain possession of them so there would not be any further damage caused. But now, as there have been calls for a damage assessment, I think the DNI, Avril Haines and others are going to have to look very carefully at how damaging this information might be to our national security interests, given that it was unsecured and it was illegally retained for this length of time.
We've talked a lot since Friday, Director Brennan, about that top secret SCI
designation, which means that it's sensitive compartmented information, which I believe means basically you got to look at it in a skiff. You, as head of the CIA at one point, saw a lot of those kind of documents. And you probably have as much window into the kinds of documents that get classified that way as anybody. So just get, without in any way suggesting you know what these documents are, because I know you don't, what are the kinds of documents that get that kind of designation?
Well, as your other panelist, Frank Figluzzi, could also attest, the top secret SCI classification and code word category refers to some of the most sensitive intelligence that the United States has been able to collect. Frequently, it deals with signals intelligence, other types of technical collection systems that are very sensitive and have taken years and even billions of dollars to try to put in place. And therefore, that TSSCI classification is designed to limit access to these documents because of the intelligence that is so sensitive in them. But also, it denotes that there needs to be very specialized handling and retention requirements attached to these documents. And so, as you pointed out, a SCIF is a sensitive class, compartmented information facility, which usually is at government departments and agencies. It is hardened. It is alarmed. It has guards around it. And so, therefore, the fact that these documents were held at Mar-a-Lago without any of those limitations and restrictions on them really makes me worry about some of these, again, sensitive, particularly on the technical side, what it could, in fact, reveal to individuals who want to gain access to it. And we know that the Russians and Chinese and other foreign adversaries have been trying for years and years to try to uncover our technical collection capabilities and systems because they're trying to, again, undermine U.S. national security interests. And sometimes it's individuals either because of their carelessness, recklessness, or because they just flout the laws and rules and regulations of the U.S. Government allow our adversaries to gain access to this information.
So, Frank, we know Mar-a-Lago is not exactly a skiff, right? In fact, quite the opposite. Mar-a-Lago has been penetrated, been probed, been had all kinds of crazy stuff has happened at Mar-a-Lago. If it's the case that there's documentation of this kind, let's just put aside the question of Trump's motive for the moment, which is obviously important. But if there's, if foreign adversaries of the United States were to learn that there were top secret or these higher classifications, even the documents on site at Mar-a-Lago, basically behind a door with a true, with a padlock on it from True Value Hardware, what would those foreign adversaries, what would they do? How would they, what would be the move at that point to try to penetrate the minimal security there is to get a hold of these documents?
Yeah, as you referenced, Mar-a-Lago seems more like a sieve than a skiff. There have been arrests related, counterintelligence investigations related to Mar-a-Lago, Chinese nationals gaining access, FBI Miami very publicly busy catching Russians and Chinese trying to get around and in to that property. So look, I cringe when I think of being assigned this damage assessment. Some poor souls in the government are going to have to figure this out. What's a damage assessment do? It is a comprehensive look backwards at where these documents were, what they represent, and who may have had access to them. When you're talking about a place like Mar-a-Lago, even if you rule out, and I'm not sure you can, but rule out the membership side, the hotel resort side, let's go with the resident side. It is a massive building with lots and lots of staff. It's a building that we have to assume has been targeted by foreign services while Trump was president. He spent many, many weekends there. So it would be a logical target, but both for human collection, sending human sources in, and also technical or SIGINT collection. There's no reason to believe that that's stopped, especially with news over the past year and a half that boxes of classified were there. So imagine, you wouldn't even have to get human penetration into the facility. Imagine the SIGINT collection, the technical collection is still in place. Imagine that a former president who doesn't use secure encrypted phones or communications, famously, his devices are still targeted. And so if you simply have discussions with his lawyers, who probably don't have appropriate clearances, about, hey, How about that TSSCI document? Hey, how about that top secret thing that mentions a source or a spy? That's being intercepted. You have to assume that when you conduct a damage assessment. And so when I say I cringe when I think about being assigned that damage assessment, you have to assume what has been compromised or misused or misplaced has been seen by an adversary. When you do that with this many documents at the TSSCI level, you have a hell of a job on your hands in terms of a damage assessment.
Frank, I stick with you just for the moment because I know you have thoughts about this matter. I mentioned that there's been a report that, you know, Trump has come out and said he told the truth, by the way, once about the fact that Mar-a-Lago had in fact been searched. Maybe he did it again today on Truth Social when he said that his passports had been taken by the FBI. As I said before, we had not confirmed this. Donald Trump's a pathological liar. He could have made this up. We don't know. However, like I said, he was told the truth once in the last week. Maybe, you know, happened twice. If it's true, what does it mean?
So I always like to start with the simplest explanation. And then, you know, although nothing is simple with the former president, the simplest explanation would be this, potentially. He likely had a black covered diplomatic passport, a red, perhaps a red government official passport. I've had these all at one time, at a time in my FBI career, and a blue tourist passport. Let's assume for the sake of argument, he had all three and they were active and or expired. He no longer has a right to possess the diplomatic or the government official. He's a former guy, right? So it's possible that within the four corners of the search warrant that say, hey, you can seize government records, that they seized passports that he has no right to have anymore and left him with his blue tourist passport. I could see that happening. This gets more complicated, though, because usually in investigations, you seize a passport when you're about to charge somebody and you're concerned they're a flight risk, or you seize a passport because it contains evidence of the crimes you're looking at. The warrant says agents can seize evidence of crimes they're looking at. What are the crimes they're looking at? Espionage. Great. So what would that mean? Well, his travel record is in his passport. Could it be possible they're looking at espionage committed while traveling? I don't know. I'm leaning toward the simpler answer. Your passport is not yours, by the way. It's the U.S. government's. It's right. A privilege to have it. They can take it back.
Right.
And you shouldn't have a diplomatic or an official passport.
But am I right, Director Brennan, I ask you, you know, am I right to just say that Frank just laid out some possibilities and there's a little bit of speculation going on, even if we knew that it for sure had happened, we'd still be speculating in the way that Frank did, I think, with a good basis. It's a big deal, right? I mean, kind of the most innocent version is of that are suggestive of some kind of severity, and the less innocent versions of it are obviously, like, you know, kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, I agree with Frank. I had maybe a dozen diplomatic passports through the course of my career. And once they either expired or when I left government, I had to turn them in and then they would be voided. I would retain the voided passport, but you have to turn it in once you are no longer with the government, whether it be diplomatic or official. And so, again, I think that's the most benign and probably the most realistic explanation, or whether or not, you know, an old passport was thrown in with some other documents that were seized. But I do not think that it was because they considered Donald Trump a flight risk, nor do they believe that they were trying to find out what his travel might have been. I think his travel is a matter of a very public record.
Yeah, Director Brennan, I think you're probably being modest. You probably have a lot of passports. Look, if we opened up your briefcase, it'd be like Jason Bourne with a lot of different names and all that stuff. I'm sure you're kind of soft-selling that. I want to get to this defense, one of the defenses that we've heard of the many defenses that Trump has offered, arguing the alternative, as the lawyers like to say, about what went on here. And this is the notion that he, in some kind of way, in almost like a papal way, declared that as soon as the document walked upstairs with him out of the Oval Office, it was automatically declassified. Kash Patel, one of his lawyers, if you can call him that, went on Fox News to make this argument. I want to play that and then, on the backside of that, say what John Bolton had to say about that argument.
President Trump, as a sitting president, is a unilateral authority for declassification. He can literally stand over a set of documents and say, these are now declassified. And that is done with definitive action immediately.
So that's Kash Patel. He went on for much longer than that. And that's the claim. Blanket declassification. There's like some automatic order in there. It's like if I touch the Ritz cracker, it becomes the Holy Eucharist on its own. Here comes John Bolton to say what he thinks about that claim.
I think that claim is almost certainly a lie. Look, when I became national security advisor, nobody briefed me or informed me that this policy or order was in effect. I spent 17 years as it felt like 17 years. I spent 17 months as national security advisor. I was never aware of anything even remotely approximating that policy, and I haven't heard anything of it since I left. If he, in fact, said something like that, when was it memorialized? When did the White House counsel write it down? To whom was it distributed? And I think one other important point, when a document is declassified, it's not just declassified as to Donald Trump, it's declassified for the whole world. So in theory, if that order existed, which I don't think it did, the news media could today file a Freedom of Information Act request for every document he declassified, which over a four-year period could be a pretty high stack. So I think this is made up, and I think a key point here is when somebody's making up stories like that, I think it indicates a level of desperation.
Director Brennan, in your history in the intelligence community, have you ever heard of a spontaneous, auto-catalytic, self-generating declassification system of the kind that Kash Patel seems to be arguing was the case in this instance?
No, I haven't. And as of late, I find myself increasingly agreeing with John Bolton, which I find a bit surprising. But it's clear that this claim of declassification is absurd on its face. And Kash Patel, who is just trying to defend Donald Trump with these absurd arguments, knows better. And as John pointed out, it's not just the document that is in Trump's possession that is declassified. It's the content, it's the intelligence in there that has to be declassified. So there needs to be an extensive record of it. And the intelligence in these documents is scattered throughout the national security community. And also, it's likely that some of that declassified information in those top secret documents also then potentially declassifies the collection systems that made that intelligence available. And so it's not just a very quick process. The normal routine is that there is going to be great scrutiny looked upon on these documents to find out what damage might be done if this information is disclosed publicly. And clearly, none of that was done by Donald Trump. And so therefore, that's why I think it's just outrageous that they're making these claims with a straight face.
Everybody on this panel is sticking around. We got to hear more from all of them. But up next, we have Rudy. Breaking news that the man once referred to as America's mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, now the target of the criminal election fraud investigation taking place in Georgia. Then more on Mar-a-Lago Gate, the unanswered questions about the scope and severity of the security threat posed by the ex-president, unaccountably holding on to all of those classified materials, and the semi-hemi-demi rift opening up inside the GOP as Trump's shifting excuses pile up and get more implausible and preposterous by the minute. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after this. Please do not go away.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Lawyers for Donald Trump's one-time personal attorney, Rudolph Giuliani, have been informed that Giuliani is now a target of the criminal investigation into election interference playing out in Georgia. That is according to a new interview in the New York Times with Giuliani attorney Robert Costello about the investigation being spearheaded by Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis. Earlier this summer, prosecutors from Willis's team asked witnesses during grand jury testimony about Giuliani's activities in regards to his efforts to keep Donald Trump in power. Giuliani scheduled to appear before that special grand jury in Atlanta on Wednesday. We're back with our panel. I want to start. We understand that Costello in this New York Times piece says that Giuliani would probably invoke attorney-client privilege and take the Fifth. He says if these people think he's going to talk about conversations between him and President Trump, they're delusional, Mr. Costello said. Mr. Costello, obviously familiar with delusional people, having represented Rudolph Giuliani in this case. Jackie, I ask you, Rudy's been a lot of trouble for a while now. Tell us how he got to this place as the target of this investigation and whether there's what the prospects are for him being able to maybe try to wriggle out of it.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a long time coming, John. Rudy Giuliani was deeply involved for an extended period of time in the former president's efforts to overturn the results of the election. And Fannie Willis has been investigating some time what she's called a multi-state coordinated plan by the Trump campaign to influence the results of the November 2020 election in Georgia and elsewhere. We know that Rudy Giuliani was one of the main points of contact for the Trump campaign and for local officials on the ground in Georgia to try to overturn the results of the election, including implementing fake slate of electors plans, which was nearly pulled off in some of these battleground states. We also know that Lindsey Graham has been asked as well to appear in this case. His legal team is planning to appeal the decision that was made recently that he must testify in the probe. But this has been a fascinating case to watch that's been running parallel with all of the other criminal investigations going on into, again, former President Trump's efforts to overturn the results of the election.
So last week, Frank Figluzzi, there was, in the middle of the kind of cascading news around Trump and Mar-a-Lago, there were a lot of things that happened, some of which we didn't pay very much attention to. I will say that one that I really was regretting we didn't get to focus on was Giuliani's lawyer saying that when it comes to this upcoming appearance before the grand jury on Wednesday, that he could not, his health was poor and he would not be able to make it down. There's no way he could possibly fly to Atlanta given that his health was bad. They went and made this case before the judge. I want to play the sound of Judge McBurney, what he had to say to that when the Giuliani lawyers tried to keep their man from having to go visit the Peachtree State.
The medical professional said that Mr. Giuliani is not cleared for air travel, AIR. John Madden drove all over the country in his big bus from stadium to stadium. So one thing we need to explore is whether Mr. Giuliani could get here without jeopardizing his recovery and his health on a train, or on a bus, or Uber, or whatever it would be. The focus seems to have been he's got to be on a plane. And New York is not close to Atlanta, but it's not traveling from Fairbanks.
The judge talking sense there, Frank, and I would also say not exhibiting a lot of sympathy for Rudy's claims, basically saying, hey, man, bus, train, Uber, be John Madden. I don't think that's possible. John Madden, a beloved figure in America. Tell us what this means that Giuliani has now been named as a target of this investigation. What is he now facing?
He may be facing a midnight train to Georgia, to quote lyrics from Gladys Knight and the Pips. He's jammed up here. Being named a target, your lawyer being told, hey, your client's a target, it's really bad. It means that the grand jury and the prosecutors are thinking, yeah, we're about to charge you. It's imminent, right? You are under criminal investigation and your name is in the header of the investigation. You're one of the named subjects and it's coming. And it's coming faster than you think. And look, his options are not good. If he claims attorney-client privilege, right, it's an admission that Trump told him to do this illegal stuff in Georgia. It's a no-win for him. And all the DA has to say is, well, okay, that's very interesting. First, your privilege doesn't extend to criminality, number one. Number two, we could stay away from what Trump said to you, if you think that's privilege. Let's just investigate what you did all by yourself with Georgia officials in an attempt to unlawfully overturn the Georgia election. We're focused on you. So it's really a no-win situation. He's going to have to plead the Fifth or incriminate himself. It's not looking good for Rudy right now.
John Brennan, with Frankie Figgs having just quoted Glasnost and the Pips, I'm going to wait maybe a Ray Charles invocation from you, Georgia, on your mind. My question, though, is this. A week ago, we would have said this Georgia case really mattered, that it was like, you know, that this was one of the central problems. Trump has a world of legal problems. He's got the Georgia problem. He's got, you know, well, look at these headlines of all these things that are happening to him in terms of the his allies are in legal trouble. The Politico says that Justice Department subpoenas former Trump White House lawyer Eric Hirschman. Politico says judge orders Lindsey Graham to testify on the Atlanta area Trump probe. We've been learning about other Trump allies who've been subpoenaed and compelled to testify in these various probes. They're all over the place. Lots of probes. The one thing that was on no one's radar screen was the thing that now, according to George Conway, is the shortest distance between Donald Trump and an orange jumpsuit. Does it surprise you that it turns out to be a thing related to classified materials and foreign policy and not something related to 1-6, election interference, or his personal businesses, other things? That's might be the thing that ends up bringing Trump down.
Well, I don't know if it's surprising, but clearly, I think Donald Trump has had a history of trying to skirt the law and to do things that are rather unethical and unprincipled, whether it be in the business world or the government world, but also now in his post-presidential life. The questions remain whether or not he has intentionally also lied and deceived the government in terms of what was being held at Mar-a-Lago. So when I hear from these, you know, legal experts and others about the potential for indictments, whether it be for Trump or Giuliani, whatever, I'm not a lawyer, but without getting too technical, I think both Rudy and Trump are screwed.
Well, that's putting it in plain English. God knows you don't need a law degree to understand that. Jackie Alleman, I got one last quick question for you, which is, you know, we referred before to Trump's declassification defense, one of many that they've floated of late. You're reporting on this story, and what you get from them is a kind of typically Trumpian changing their story in mutually often contradictory ways over time. But they're flinging stuff at the wall like a bunch of crazed monkeys. And do you have a sense that there's a defense that they're going to settle on and that's going to be now the defense? Or are you going to continue to see this kind of arguing the alternative where just basically any argument they're going to fling at reporters, fling at the courts, fling in the political system and see if something sticks?
Yeah, well, despite all the flinging, the one thing that has remained consistent is that Trump's team has not denied that there was classified information on the premises. Now it's just trying to find ways to discredit the work of the FBI and discredit the classification process more broadly speaking. And it is worth really clearly pointing out that no, the declassification process does not work the way Kash Patel has said, and that actually it would require communication and sign off from the agency head in order to declassify a certain document in order to make sure and ensure that there wasn't any risk to national security. But I think that the final defense of the Trump team has yet to be landed on. It's something that the former president is huddling with his allies and trying to figure out at Bedminster today. We knew and reported last week that he did try to bring on lawyer John Sale, who was a prominent prosecutor during the Watergate hearings. And Sale ultimately said he was honored to be asked, but turned down the offer to represent the former president. So they are trying to stitch together some sort of defense. But I do think at the end of the day, Trump has sort of gone through most of the lawyers who, at least high caliber lawyers, who would be willing to represent him in such a matter. And that's why we're seeing some of the most prominent voices out there are people like Kash Patel, Lindsey Halligan, lawyers that maybe sort of we've never heard of before and do not have experience defending white collar criminal cases.
That is putting it kindly. Jackie Alemany and Frank Figluzzi, we fling our thanks to both of you and we hope that it sticks. John Brennan is sticking around for more of my lame attempts to make it laugh. After the break, the known unknowns and Trump's secret Mar-a-Lago documents and the concerns, those unanswered questions raised about national security. We're going deep with John Brennan after this message. Among what feels like thousands of questions still unanswered a week after the FBI's search at Mar-a-Lago, there are five big ones still at the top of our minds. Number one, why weren't the documents returned in the first place at the end of Donald Trump's term in January, time when he's supposed to turn everything back over to the government, or in June, when federal investigators came to Mar-a-Lago to discuss the document issue? All of these opportunities to potentially avoid an FBI search and potentially legal liability. Number two, who did Trump talk to? Who did he consult regarding what was kept at Mar-a-Lago? And further, how truthful was he with the people around him? What did he tell his attorney, Christina Bob, for instance? Number three, were any documents destroyed at any point by Donald Trump or anyone else? Number four, why was there such urgency around executing this search warrant after months of back and forth? And finally, what formal steps were taken in the area of declassification, if any? Joining us now, we have David Loftman, former chief of the Counterintelligence and Export Control Section of the Justice Department's National Security Division, and John Brennan. He's back with us. David, I guess I want to start with you and just, you know, that part of the DOJ was involved in this search. When you look, if you think about those five questions that we've kind of pulled out there, which of those stand out to you as the most urgent in your mind, and which do you think we might actually get answers to in a timely fashion?
Well, before you get to the why weren't they returned is the kind of threshold question. Why were they taken in the first place and who was involved in those decisions? To what extent was Trump involved in determining, you know, whether to take classified information to Mar-a-Lago, what documents to select, and why? On the return question, it's kind of inextricably intertwined with the first question. But of a special interest to me are the representations made to the government by Trump's own lawyer upon further inquiry and following a grand jury subpoena that there were no more classified documents to return. And it begs the question of whether the attorney in good faith told the government there was nothing more of a classified nature at Mar-a-Lago and Trump, in essence, lied to his attorney, or she was not acting in good faith. And I had a case as a Department of Justice prosecutor involving a Chinese company lying to us about the cessation of shipments of U.S. origin goods to Iran, where they were telling their attorney, who was telling us, that that had stopped. It turned out not to be the case. They wound up having to plead guilty and eat a felony with respect to false statements to the government. We determined through our investigation that the attorney was unwitting, but it was kind of a white-knuckle time for the attorney, you might imagine. And so that piece of it, I think, has to be unpacked. The attorney, you know, could have some exposure herself if she knowingly made false statements to the government. Otherwise, she's going to have to talk to her client. And if she determines that her client was not truthful to her, she ought to withdraw from this engagement immediately.
John Brennan, I ask you of those five questions or any other questions on your mind, like what are the burning issues in your mind, the things we really don't know that we really need to know if we're going to understand what this is all about?
Well, the question I have is, why was he retaining these documents? And these are documents that don't lie around the Oval Office. These are kept in very secure files and facilities at the National Security Council, as well as at the White House. And so why were they taken out? What possible use was Donald Trump thinking about making of them, or what use did he make of it already? I think there's a lot of questions here about the motivation behind his taking these documents out of the White House and then retaining them despite efforts by the National Archives and Department of Justice to get them back. And so, as my former colleague David, who knows these issues very well, can attest, these are questions that I think that the FBI, Department of Justice, is going to be looking at, not only what he was intending to do with them, but what he has done with them over the course of the last 20 months. Top secret SCI documents and other documents, were they in fact used by Donald Trump in some type of unauthorized, illegal manner? And then what is the impact of that use on our national security?
I mean, John, I'm going to stick with you and then I'll come back to David. I just on this question, it's obviously on a lot of people's minds. And I would say that over the weekend, people who are really anti-Trump, I mean, serious never Trumpers, you know, who have had a strong point of view, which basically says Trump's a pathological narcissist. He's basically, this is not about like trying to monetize these things or trying to advance any interest. He's like, these are my documents. I'm going to keep these documents. It's just an exercise in ego, stamping his feet. Don't tell me what to do. I'm going to keep these documents. And these people do not like Donald Trump. Other people look at this and say, you know,
there's got to be a scam here. There's got to be some way in which he's trying to monetize these documents or trying to advance his interest in some much more tangible way. I asked you, as a student of psychology and someone who, as the head of the CIA, was called upon to do that in a lot of cases, look at world leaders and say, what drives this person? What motivates this person? What's your gut say about the range of possibilities that are like really in play here when it comes to Donald Trump and potentially things like nuclear secrets?
Well, there certainly is a range. I don't want to speculate too much, but we know that Donald Trump has pursued a very personal agenda over the course of his life, whether it be in business or politics or in government. And so, therefore, what is it that he might have thought that he could, what benefit to derive from this? Did he want to be able to refer to these documents before any types of conversations he might have with foreign leaders or for his business interests or whatever? Maybe he felt that they were going to help to inform him or others about certain actions or decisions he had to take. I don't know. And that's where I think the Department of Justice and the prosecutors and others are going to really have to take a look and talk to people who may be knowledgeable about some of the reasons behind why he took these documents out of the White House and down to Mar-a-Lago and what he might have done with it. I think with further investigation, we might get some insight into what his motivations have been.
David, as I said before, former chief of the counterintelligence and export control section of the Justice Department's National Security Division, someone who, if you were still in your job, you would have had a lot of direct interaction with this particular investigation. The question of the urgency, and John Brennan said before that getting these documents back may have been the main thing that Merrick Garland wanted, that there was some really intense urgency. We had to get these documents back in our hands because they posed some significant threat. Given all the things you know about how this stuff works and what the potential threats are out there, that is a riddle I'd love for you to kind of talk about, how we understand a thing that was proceeding on a relatively leisurely pace and in a pretty cooperative way, suddenly escalating this quickly. What do you imagine that could be about?
Well, it's possible the government learned more through cooperating witnesses who are either identified directly or indirectly in the search warrant affidavit, which remains under seal, that accelerated their level of concern and sense of urgency. There's nothing that worries the FBI and the department more than learning that classified information, highly classified information, SCI code word information, like John was talking about, is out there in the wild and in the possession and custody of someone who has a cavalier view toward protecting U.S. national security interests, like this former president. So at some point, I think they ratcheted up to, you know, a code red level of concern and elected to seek compulsory process through a search warrant instead of trying to resolve it amicably, understanding that this was kind of a bit of a dance they were going through with a former president. They had to be mindful that there were political considerations and ramifications of taking this step. They must have felt the desire to exercise all more reasonable alternatives, even the, you know, not so reasonable, but still quiet alternative of a search of a grand jury subpoena, until they determined that the representations made to them were untruthful and they had no choice but to act, but to obtain a search warrant.
David Loffman, John Brennan are sticking around for more on all of this. These big questions still unanswered that we all have to ponder coming up after the break.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Get the best of MSNBC all in one place every day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning in your inbox, you'll find expert analysis, video highlights of your favorite shows.
Running for re-election is when you actually get your report card from the American people.
Previews from our podcasts and documentaries, as well as written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves. Understand today's news. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
We've got a little bit of breaking news here to report. Federal prosecutors have asked the judge overseeing the Trump search warrant matter to keep the affidavit that has not been released and that a lot of people want to see, which would contain the DOJ's reasonings for the search, sealed. The DOJ citing the need to, quote, protect the integrity of an ongoing law enforcement investigation that implicates national security. Of course, a lot of Republicans and some in the press would like to see that affidavit. In fact, I think we'd all like to see it, although that may not be a good justification for releasing it. We're back with David Laufman and John Brennan. And I want to come back around to what we were talking about a second ago, guys. You know, one of the pieces, the most explosive piece of reporting that we saw last week was the Washington Post coming out and saying that nuclear weapons of somehow were implicated in some of these classified materials. We know that the classification on some of them does not either prove or either confirm or deny that nuclear weapons were part of the documents or mentioned in the documents that were retrieved from Mar-a-Lago. But John Brennan, I ask you, you know, is it reasonable to ask the question? Or is it just crazy conspiracy theorizing to think about and start investigating the questions related to whether Donald Trump had those kinds of documents and what potential either political or profit motive he might be pursuing? What would be the reason for having those, and what might he stand to gain in a world where those things are that kind of information is very valuable to a lot of people?
Yeah, it's one of the most concerning aspects of this. The Washington Post reporting that came out indicated that there were some nuclear-related material in these documents that were being held at Mar-a-Lago. And they're all different types of nuclear information. And I must point out, though, that some of the information related to U.S. nuclear weapons and forced posture is covered under the Atomic Energy Act. And it's not subject to the declassification rules and procedures. And it is some of the most tightly held and most closely compartmented information in the U.S. government. And the President of the United States has access to that information. I remember when I worked at the White House, it was something I had access to while there, but I didn't have access to it while I was director of CIA, given the supreme sensitivity of it and the very limited need to know on the part of U.S. senior officials. So I do think it's critically important to understand exactly what might have been within that trove of documents that has been retrieved, whether or not there's nuclear material in there. And again, getting back to what might have happened over the last 20 months, I do think foreign intelligence services, the Russians and the Chinese, could have easily tried to get people into Mar-a-Lago to gain access to what was an unsecured facility and the availability of these documents that were kept in the files there. And so therefore, I do think it may have been part of the urgency that the Department of Justice, the FBI, the intelligence community really felt, that maybe they became aware of some things that were missing in the White House or some files that was critically important to get back as soon as possible because of the damage it could do to national security if, in fact, it was subject to unauthorized disclosure.
David, and of course, what the Washington Post said was that in reporting that nuclear weapons were involved in or in some way implicated in these documents, they pointed out when asked about it, they said, well, it doesn't necessarily have to be about America's nuclear program. It could be about someone else's nuclear program that the United States government has information about. And that, again, raises a whole other set of potential specters of abuse when you're talking about a former president who not that long ago had Saudi Arabia having a golf tournament at Bedminster. I do want to ask you about destruction of evidence. Here's what it says in the warrant. About attachment B, bullet point D. All physical documents and records constituting evidence, contraband, fruits of crime, or other items illegally possessed in violation of 18 U.S.C. 793, 2071, or 1519, including the following, any evidence of the knowing alteration, destruction, or concealment of any government and or presidential records or any documents with classification. Can you explain what that's about? What does that mean? What is it the DOJ is trying to figure out there? What are they after?
Well, that language is there because it corresponds to the language in a statute referenced on the face of the warrant that was a basis for probable cause. And clearly the government obtained a lot of information that the president remained in custody of lots of presidential records, some of which turned out to be classified, but presidential records nonetheless. And there was an ongoing government investigation to recover presidential records, which it appears Mr. Trump and his team there were thwarting. So the reason that is there is because it's consistent with one of the bases advanced to the magistrate judge for determining that probable cause existed, that a crime had been committed, and that evidence of that crime, here the concealment of presidential records, would be found at Mar-a-Lago. One other point about the nuclear records, John, just for a second. You know, this is a president who famously had poor reading habits as president. You know, he didn't like to read documents. Why on earth would he choose to take among the most highly classified documents, you know, in his reach down to a Florida clubhouse, unless he had some illicit motivation? It boggles the mind what that motivation may be. And, you know, John and I don't want our minds to wander too far, but I can't imagine any purpose. You know, he's not going to be reading, you know, these things next to his Kindle at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, why on earth would he have this stuff down there? That's got to be one of the central questions that the Department of Justice and the FBI are trying to answer.
Central question. You guys both have big minds, and when they wander, it's usually they take us to an interesting place. In this case, if your minds wander too much, it takes us to a very dark and scary place. David Loffman, John Brennan, thank you for spending some time with us. I would love to have discussed the Roger Stone issue with you guys. We'll get that next time. The next hour of Deadline White House starts right after this quick break.
I'm not one of the individuals out there that says that you immediately attack the FBI or the Justice Department. But I think it's very important long term for the Justice Department, now that they've done this, that they show that this was not just a fishing expedition.
It was an unprecedented action that needs to be supported by unprecedented justification. I've urged all my colleagues to make sure they understand the weight of their words.
Aloha, namaste, and guten tag, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York City. I'm John Hyman, in again for Nicole Wallace. From the moment that Donald Trump revealed that the FBI had searched Mar-a-Lago last week and for several days thereafter, the outrage pouring forth from Republicans and directed at federal law enforcement was voluble, incendiary, and nearly unanimous. A week later, however, a fissure has opened up within the Republican Party. The New York Times reporting, quote, Republicans have struggled to coalesce around a unified strategy to respond to the FBI's search of Mar-a-Lago, Trump's home in Palm Beach, Florida, amid daily revelations and quickly shifting explanations, excuses, defenses, and false accusations by the former president. On one side, there are those Republicans still unequivocally backing the former president and casting aspersions on the FBI, DOJ, and other law enforcement officials. Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, of course, started selling defund the FBI merchandise, while Senator Rand Paul this weekend called for a repeal of the Espionage Act, one of the statutes that we now know, thanks to that unsealed search warrant, that the search of Mar-a-Lago was predicated upon. Meanwhile, on the other side of this intra-Republican divide, it's a shallow one, but it's a divide nonetheless, are those members of the GOP taking a more cautious and circumspect stance, maintaining their criticisms of Attorney General Merrick Garland and pushing for more information from him and the DOJ, but also acknowledging that the harsh anti-law enforcement rhetoric from some others in their party could have serious and even deadly consequences. Consequences we saw start to develop on Thursday when the FBI field office in Cincinnati was attacked, and on Friday when a new bulletin was issued by the Department of Homeland Security warning of, quote, an increase in threats and acts of violence, including armed encounters against law enforcement, judiciary, and government personnel after the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago. On top of all those threats, the story about what happened here from Trump world just keeps on changing, making the narrative harder to defend for Republicans. More from the New York Times, quote, the shifting explanations have made it difficult for Republicans, many of whom are eager to please the former president, to come together with a unified defense. They are divided about whether to attack the nation's top law enforcement agencies and how aggressive to be in those attacks. Democratic Senator from Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar, pointed out the hypocrisy on display.
I thought in the old days the Republican Party used to stand with law enforcement, and I hope some of them do today, because this kind of rhetoric is very dangerous to our country.
Joining us now, Washington Post national investigative reporter Carol Lenig, also Jake Sherman, co-founder of Punchbowl News, and the one and only Charlie Sykes, editor-at-large of The Bulwark. They're all MSNBC contributors. And Charlie, you're the card-carrying, or used-to-be card-carrying, semi-hemi-demi Republican here, so I ask you. It was bad last week when we saw the Republican Party basically just go after law enforcement. We talked about this on the air last week. You talk about the fissure, to the extent there is a fissure, that's developing now? What's driving the fact that at least some Republicans seem to be having second thoughts about going all in on trashing law enforcement?
Well, they may be having second thoughts because they realize what a uniquely dangerous moment this is and how they are feeding into this burning dumpster fire of anger that is out there. But I mean, the hypocrisy for a party that has claimed that it is the party of law and order, the party that backs the blue, has been on display for some time. They certainly did not back the blue on January 6th. And a lot of this runs very, very deep on the right. I think it was back in the 1990s that you had Wayne LaPierre of the National Rifle Association referring to federal agents as jackbooted thugs and raised the specter of black helicopters. And of course, Donald Trump has been trying to delegitimize any institution that comes after him. But, you know, it is interesting, you know, watching them try to finesse all this, particularly with Donald Trump constantly changing his explanation. And so much of our politics now is just pretext. It doesn't matter what the facts are. It's constantly changing. All that matters is what side you are on. So, you know, whether it is lies about the election, and, you know, we would ask in the reality we live in, you know, where is the evidence? Where is the proof? And it doesn't really matter because this is what you have to believe. And it is more important to be supportive of your tribe, or in this case, the cult of personality leader down in Mar-a-Lago. Eventually, they will get around to coming up with some sort of a position that will enable them to, you know, continue to rationalize what they have rationalized so often in the past. For people who think that this is going to be the moment that Republicans or the right breaks with Donald Trump, I guess I would ask, where have you been for the last 6 years? They've swallowed everything so far. Why do you think this will be different?
Jake, the thing that kept ringing in my head at the end of last week, when you started to see at least some senators try to be like a little more circumspect, people like McConnell, Lindsey Graham, even to some extent, was it reminded me a little bit of the early days of the Ukraine war and the notion that there was that moment where Trump was saying nice things about Putin and you could see the temptation of the Republican Party to go down that path. And then it wasn't, I don't think, that they looked up and said that would be wrong. They looked up and said, our base will not tolerate this. We can't be pro-Putin, outwardly pro-Putin. And so I wonder whether that's part of the case here when they've started to realize, people up on Capitol Hill where you sit all day long, they started to realize, we don't really know what we're into here with Trump. Like Trump, there could be, if there's nuclear secrets down at Mar-a-Lago, that could destroy us politically if we side with him too aggressively. For some of them, I wonder if it's political calculation, not concern about the possible damage of attacking law enforcement.
I think that's true, John. I think a few things. Number one, they, as you said, they have no idea what Trump has done, which makes him particularly difficult to defend. Now, I just want to raise something on the heels of what Charlie said, which is the defund FBI movement, I guess you could say, is dangerous in and of itself, because we should not, of course, defund the nation's top law enforcement entity. I don't think there's anybody in their right mind who thinks that's the right idea. But if Republicans take the majority, and I don't know whether they will or they won't, I think there's a decent chance that they take the House majority. Are you going to have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and people of that ilk who want to hold up spending bills to defund the FBI? I mean, that's not far off from a possibility or a reality that Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise theoretically are going to have to contend with in the next 8 months or so. I mean, I know it's just a fundraising ploy at the moment, but I noticed Beau Hinds, who's a Republican who's likely to be a member of Congress from North Carolina, said that we need to defund the FBI. I mean, you'll remember in 2010, 2012, Republicans took the idea of defunding the healthcare law, something that could not happened given Barack Obama was in the White House. This caused government shutdowns and all sorts of legislative calamities. So is there a possibility that this becomes part of that general strategy? I would say that there seems to be an even chance that that could happen if this continues to snowball. And if, by the way, this gets worse for Trump, people who are Trump aligned in the House GOP, which is 75% of the House Republican conference, are they going to look for a scapegoat? And is the FBI that legislative scapegoat?
Well, that's all really good questions. And Carol, I you know, you don't have to go. Marjorie Taylor Greene is a unfortunately too close to the mainstream of the Republican Party now. But you get people like Mike Turner. I want to play this. He's a congressman from Ohio, ranking member on the House Intel Committee. He's on CNN yesterday trying to like navigate this situation. He doesn't want to be Marjorie Taylor Greene, but he also doesn't want to be that far away from Marjorie Taylor Greene. So he's kind of defending Donald Trump. And then this happened.
Do you take home documents marked special access?
No.
And yet you're casting doubt.
And, you know, quite frankly, you know, I've been in the Oval Office with the president. I'd be very surprised if he has actual documents that rise to the level of immediate national security threat.
You yourself would not take home documents that are marked special access. You would not take home this sensitive, compartmented information.
Remember what I'm casting doubt on. I mean, these are labeled that. We don't know whether or not these are classified and rise to the level.
Turner was actually on TV last week also with like saying there are things that are classified, but they're not really deeply classified. They're sort of classified, but I don't know if it's really, I don't know. The silence there, Carol, the silence of when he's asked that question, would you do this? And him just, his political future running through it. If I say the wrong thing, Donald Trump will primary me. It'll all be over. This is what all these guys are going through right now. Every moment they're asked a very basic, simple question like that, they have to think through every potential consequence of whether they're going to enrage the dear leader. It's just not a real way to run a railroad, it seems to me, if you're in the Republican Party.
Well, it's the way things have been going for a year and a half, right? I mean, Lindsey Graham saying, our long, strange trip is over, Donald Trump, after January 6th, and then changing his mind when he realized Donald Trump wasn't done for after January 6th. Donald Trump was only ascendant as the leader of the party, de facto leader, at least. There is very little that the president, the former president, could do that would sort of shake the Republican Party members' faith in him, at least their public faith in him, their public pronouncements about what he says goes, because that's important to them, getting his voters. You know, I also would like to reiterate something Charlie said. It can't be repeated enough. It depends on, you know, which tribe you're a part of, apparently, in America, because I remember reporting on Hillary Clinton's emails. You know, it was inappropriate and a violation of, if not the law, the spirit of the law, for her to handle classified materials on a private server. It just was. Jim Comey, the FBI director, made a decision that he felt it wasn't necessary to prosecute her for this violation. But I remember being told by her lawyers, you know, they weren't marked and labeled classified. They weren't properly marked, you know, so we don't know what we're dealing with here. But it was classified information. And the same thing is being said now as you play in this clip by Mike Turner. It's just a reminder that, you know, the facts are the facts. And everybody should be guided by those. And right now, a lot of Republicans are squeamish because they don't know all the facts behind the curtain at Mar-a-Lago. And they don't know all the facts that the Department of Justice has about what appears to be the much larger investigation into a conspiracy to defraud the government and an effort to interfere in the federal election.
Jake, I saw you raising your hand. Whenever I see you raising your hand, I know you got something to say. What do you got to say? Get in here, man.
I just want to elaborate on the Mike Turner thing. I mean, this is somebody who has access to some of the highest intel, highest classified intel that the U.S. government has. I asked him last week, I said, is there any situation in which you believe the FBI should be going into the president's house to investigate intelligence that he has at his home? And he basically said it would have to be. He basically said no. He said the universe of things, the universe of intelligence that would require the FBI to do that is so limited that I can't imagine a justification for doing this, which is just stunning to somebody, as Carol just noted. This is somebody who does have access to this information. Yeah. So yeah. Even somebody who has spent his career around this information is still defending Trump and casting doubt on the FBI's tactics. And by the way, Republicans and Democrats have indicated that they want more information on the underlying facts. That's not a controversial point of view to say, hey, we oversee you. We'd like to know more. But Turner is saying, actually, I don't even need to. He wants more. But he's saying, even so, I don't believe the FBI had the right to go in there.
Right. Well, not surprising. Again, we go, everything always comes back to Trump. Here's this piece, this Luke Broadwater piece about that's headlined. Some Republicans make a more restrained case for defending Trump. But the part I want to read is this part. The former president, Donald Trump, that is, has worked to cash in on the Mar-a-Lago search. Mr. Trump's political action committee has been furiously fundraising off the FBI search, sending out at least 17 text messages to donors since Tuesday. Quote, the Dems broke into the home of President Trump, one read. This is political targeting, another alleged. They're coming after you, a third said. Charlie Sykes, there's not been a moment since this happened in this bizarro, upside-down world that we live in. There's not been a moment when it hasn't seemed like Donald Trump he's looked legally panicked at various points. Like he's doing stuff that shows that he's a little freaked out about his legal liability. But politically, everybody around him keeps saying he thinks he's winning. And this is another sign of it. And the flex of that fundraising effort. Do you think he's right that this is in fact consolidating largely the Republican Party behind Donald Trump? Or is the fissure that we're talking about here something that he should be worried about in the future?
This is the reptilian instinct that I think that Donald Trump has, that he knows that he needs to play the martyr card. And when he does, what he can say is they're not just coming after me, they're coming after you. And the Republican base is, in fact, rallying around him. You know, and you talk to any Republicans anywhere in the country, and they will say that that, in fact, you know, he's under attack. That is an attack on us. So that works in his favor. Up until, you know, something actually tangibly happens. So, yes, there are Republicans right now who are worried because they don't know what is in those documents, what Donald Trump has done, what Donald Trump will demand of them. And they're nervous about what they will have to defend because they know they will have to defend it. We've seen this over and over and over again. There is no mystery about the president's lies about the election or his role in January 6th. There was no mystery about the fact that he has obstructed justice in the past, and yet they have defended all of this. So the fissure that you're seeing now is that sort of, you know, early, you know, the one swallow that makes you think that it is summertime, but it's, you know, eventually they will rally around him. I mean, because that is what they do. And you're seeing this right now. And I think there are a lot of folks who were, you know, even among the anti-Trump folks who were thinking that, well, maybe we can turn the page on Donald Trump and move on to Ron DeSantis. What they're seeing right now is a lot of Republicans going, no, we have to rally around our besieged orange God King. And that is what's happening, at least in the short term.
Carol, my question, you know, there's a question that people have been asking in this, in the light of the way in which, you know, people like the DeSantis people are quaking in their boots and like, oh my God, we can't take on Trump now. He's obviously going to be the nominee if he wants to be the nominee. People ask this question, the obvious question, which is, man, is it really possible that the Republican Party, the party of peace through strength, the party of Ronald Reagan, the party of, you know, of national defense and all the things that have been built on the Republican Party in the past, that that party could nominate someone who is a bona fide national security threat? I have a different question, though. In addition to that, it's the same question, just writ larger. Is it possible the Republican Party could end up nominating someone who's under indictment for having broken the laws like the Espionage Act that it seems that Donald Trump maybe has done?
Wow. I'm gulping thinking about how to answer that one, John. I would say that, you know, every single week as reporters covering the Trump presidency, many of us sat together and asked, oh, my goodness, is this the moment when people are going to say enough is enough? Is it when he calls African countries S-hole countries? Is it going to be when he gives sources and methods inadvertently to the Russian prime minister, forgive me, the Russian foreign minister about a strike in the Middle East? Is it going to be when he sits with Putin and congratulates him on a rigged election after being told, do not congratulate, you know, the number one adversary to the country? What is the thing that is going to make Donald Trump's followers and Republican lawmakers finally break. And I can't say for sure whether someone being prosecuted by the Department of Justice in the form of Donald Trump will be that thing. I can't say that.
Jake and Charlie, I'm going to ask you one word answer because we got to go to break. Jake, can you imagine a world where the Republican Party would nominate someone under indictment for violating the Espionage Act? Yes or no?
Yes.
And that person is Donald Trump, I mean. Yes? Yes?
Yes.
Charlie?
Yes.
Yes. Yes,
all right.
Absolutely.
So we have Carol doesn't want to go there. Jake and Charlie are like, yep, that's where we're headed. Anyway, Carol Lennig still trying to maintain some detachment to a world not governed by insanity and where Donald Trump is the orange god king that Charlie talked about. Jake and Charlie are sticking with us when we return. The ever-evolving stream of excuses and explanations from Donald Trump and his allies about the classified documents he was keeping at Mar-a-Lago. It is a playbook that Trump has run many times before. Plus, why Liz Cheney is expected to feed in tomorrow's Republican primary in Wyoming likely won't be the end of the line for one of the country's highest profile anti-Trump Republicans. And as the celebrated author Salman Rushdie recovers from that stabbing attack that we heard about on Friday, we are learning more about what motivated his assailant, and it's not great. Deadline White House continues after a quick break, so do not go anywhere.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Investigations into the former president have become so common that we're seeing him employ the same defense strategy over and over and over. First, preemptively speak to some detail that he knows is bound to get out by saying it didn't happen, but if it did happen, it's okay because whatever, whatever, and then make up some ridiculous caveat or lie. And that's just what we saw following the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago. As the New York Times writes, quote, first Trump said that he was, quote, cooperating with government agents who he claimed had inappropriately entered his home. Then, when the government revealed that the FBI, during its search, had recovered nearly a dozen sets of documents that were marked classified, he suggested that the agents had planted the evidence. Finally, his aides said that he had a standing order to declassify all documents that left the Oval Office for his residence, and that some of the material was protected by attorney-client and executive privilege. So, okay, just to make this as simple as possible, what we have here is a story that started with Trump saying, I didn't take the documents, and then became, well, the documents that were there were planted, which then became, if the documents weren't planted, then they weren't classified, and now today it's, okay, if they were once classified, it doesn't matter anymore because the moment that Trump touched them, he declassified them. That, I think, is what's going on here. We're back with Jake Sherman and Charlie Sykes. It's like a who's on first revolving door thing, Charlie. But we've seen it before from Donald Trump. I keep asking the question. I know Republicans don't have any principles, but my question is whether the ludicrousness, the preposterousness of this kind of revolving door of arguing the alternative, as the lawyers say, whether at some point that will be a thing that Republicans on an issue this important will just be like, got to stay away from that. It's too toxic. It's going to kill me.
Well, you would think so, especially when the former president of the United States is essentially using the O.J. Simpson defense. They planted. I mean, think about that for a moment, that the former president is suggesting that if there's something really bad that they found in my locked room at Mar-a-Lago, the FBI agents planted it. I mean, that is the kind of conspiracy theory that a few years ago you would have found, say, on InfoWars, an Alex Jones show or something like that. It is so outlandish. But what Donald Trump has calculated, quite frankly, with his reptilian instinct, is that he knows that he can throw anything against the wall. He can make any claim, no matter how outlandish. He can push any conspiracy theory, no matter how absolutely baseless. and it will work for him. It will not cause a break in his party, and enough people will believe it that it will become a talking point. I mean, earlier here on MSNBC, I heard a soundbite from Wyoming where there was a voter, one of the voters who's going to vote to oust Liz Cheney, very confidently saying, well, you know, why don't we investigate all the FBI agents who were inciting the riots on January 6th. There's no basis for that, but you get people to believe it. So Donald Trump has really learned from the last 6 years about what he can get away with, how gullible people are, and how reluctant members of his own party are to call him out for, you know, blatant bull roar when it comes to this sort of thing. Because as you lay out, it makes no sense. It is ridiculous. It is ludicrous. But you know, right now, the vast majority of Republicans believe some of his ludicrous conspiracy theories about the election. And he's sitting down there going, I'm just going to play the same thing. Worked for me before. Why not this time?
Charlie, did you just say bull roar? Is that what you said? Was that just a...
I restrained myself from using the word that I wanted to use.
Yeah, okay. Usually yeah. The people go for bull crap. That's fine. But bull roar, that's not one I've never heard before. It must be a Wisconsin thing. Jake, you know, when we were talking in the last blog about the fissure, and, you know, I said shallow fissure. It's not a giant fissure. It's a little bit of a fissure. Here's the thing that has, like, of all the crazy stuff we've seen in the last week, here's a little thing that has freaked me out more than anything else, because I'm trying to figure it out. Maybe you will hold the key, because on the face of it, it's inexplicable. Steve Doocy repeatedly on Fox News last week, and we never play Fox News in the show, but we're going to play this. Steve Doocy all of a sudden was like sounding like rational. Let's play this for my friends at the recount.
Destroy the FBI. We must save America. Whatever happened to the Republican Party backing the blue?
This is coming
Steve,
from
the top. Steve, who went rogue? They were following a search warrant. Nuclear weapons. We don't know if there are weapons, but if that is true, and they were just in the basement at Mar-a-Lago, that's kind of a big deal.
Well, certainly.
It will allow Medicare to negotiate lower prescription drug prices. And I, you know, if you are on a fixed income, if you're older, you love that, regardless of your political party.
You love how it sounds.
Deeply, deeply concerned about the politicization of the FBI and Biden's DOJ.
Well, of course, the FBI director was appointed by Donald Trump, the former president. But Congresswoman, and just out of curiosity, are you wearing Bermuda shorts right now?
I mean, Doocy. Like, I don't even get it there. You could look on Kilmeade's face. I mean, he looked like he was going to just walk over there and, like, strangle Doocy at any moment. It's funny. It's weird. Is he on drugs? Is there an agenda here? Is it a sign of something bigger that Fox News is full? You know, tell me, Jake. Help me understand.
You're giving me the most unfair assignment, John, which is to analyze the personalities at Fox News. I have literally zero idea what's going through their minds. But it does seem as if they are, I'll be honest with you. I mean, it's almost like he's been put on truth serum, because this is what a lot of Republicans say behind the scenes. And I know that's not satisfying to a lot of people, but of course, this is not an FBI agent gone rogue. This is somebody who was following a search warrant and went through a court process. Of course, it's problematic if there's seriously classified material in Mar-a-Lago. Of course, it's and Republicans said this time and time again, of course, it's politically popular to lower drug prices for old people. I cannot put Steve Doocy on a therapist's couch. Far be it for me to try, but it is quite interesting, to say the least.
Charlie, I mean, if Doocy keeps this up, what do you think his odds of short-term survival are, number one? And number two, is that indicative of some, like, there's been some discussion about Fox News possibly being sick of Trump and making the move into DeSantis land over the course of the last few weeks or months. Do you think there's anything to that?
Well, first of all, when I was watching that, I was thinking that I'm guessing that he already has tickets booked on a around the world cruise, because that looked like a guy who was planning for his retirement. Look, the problem with Fox News is this is a we often think of these things as being top down. They are captive to their audience and what their audience demands. And if the audience, you know, continues to demand, you know, Trump is propaganda, that's what they will give them, even though clearly they would, you know, some of them would like to move on. I mean, you even have Laura Ingraham out suggesting that maybe it's time to turn the page. I mean, she is an absolute hardcore. She's a hardcore loyalist, but there's a certain exhaustion. I mean, how much of this can you carry? How many rationalizations can you make? How many, you know, how many lies can you, you know, find a way to, you know, polish up? And so there might be an exhaustion there, but I don't see that Fox News is going to be breaking with its base or its audience anytime soon. You know, despite the fact that Rupert Murdoch clearly has his own doubts. I mean, you're seeing that in the Wall Street Journal. You're seeing that in the New York Post. And maybe at some point that will trickle down, but I wouldn't hold my breath.
I don't know what explains it. I will say maybe for the first time ever about someone on Fox News. Ducey? You go, girl. Jake Sherman, thank you. Charlie Sykes, sticking around. When we come back, Liz Cheney may be heading for defeat in tomorrow's Republican primary in Wyoming, but her fight against Donald Trump is far from over. That's ahead. Tomorrow, the voters of Wyoming will go to the polls to decide whether Liz Cheney will get to keep her seat in the House of Representatives, and the odds appear to be very much against her. New polling shows Cheney trailing in the primary, the Republican Party behind her Trump-endorsed opponents by 29 points. That's a lot of points, way outside the margin of error. No matter what happens tomorrow, Cheney doesn't appear to be done with politics just yet. According to reporting in the Washington Post, quote, Cheney will exit the Capitol likely in 4.5 months as the face of the anti-Trump movement that has cost her her old alliances, but left her with new supporters clamoring for a next act more nationally focused. She sees her future role similar to how she views the work of the January 6th committee, blocking any path for Donald Trump back to the Oval Office. Let's bring in NBC News correspondent, my friend Vaughn Hilliard, live in Jackson, Wyoming. It must be awesome out there right now. Charlie Sykes is still with us. Vaughn, you're at the center of the political universe out there on the campaign trail, often as is the case. Tell us, it seems like Cheney is not doing much. I mean, it's a little weird, right? You're running in a primary. She hasn't been seen doing a public event for quite a long time, more than a week. Talk about what's going on out there.
Right. I think it's important. Her team is not commenting on the security issues. At the same time, for the better part of more than a year now, she has had a special Capitol Police detail following her around the country. And individuals that get those details have credible threats that have been posed against them. So I think that's important context when we're talking about Liz Cheney's ability to campaign. But compare that to Harriet Hageman, the Trump-backed challenger that she is facing, who has traversed this state for the better part of this last year, meeting with Republican activists. I think it's important to note, you know, if I could, John, let me just read a list of a couple Republican House member names. Tom Rice, Jamie Herrera Butler, Peter Meyer, John Katko, Fred Upton, Anthony Gonzalez, Adam Kinzinger. We've run around the country the last several months covering primaries. Each of those members, Republican members whose names I just read, voted to impeach Donald Trump after the January 6th insurrection. That entire list will not be returning to the Congress next year. To cap all of this off, it's Liz Cheney's race tomorrow. And when I was here back at the end of May, when Donald Trump flew into Casper, Wyoming to hold the rally alongside Harriet Hageman, the talk at the time was, could these January 6th public hearings that Liz Cheney was going to helm, could they sway public opinion, Republican voters' opinions? 4 months later, ultimately, we're going to find out here tomorrow about what Wyoming Republicans, who 44 years ago elected her father, Dick Cheney, to this congressional seat, this very congressional seat, whether they have been swayed to what extent. That is the case, John.
Vaughn, you know, there was some discussion at the end of last week about when she came out and attacked Republicans who were attacking law enforcement, and that there was some speculation by David Axelrod on Twitter and others who said that that maybe some of her lack of campaign activity had to do with security threats. We don't know if that's the case, but it's certainly the case, as you point out, that she has had special protection for a while, and she's been not doing anything like the kind of public events that especially a candidate who's like supposedly fighting for her life and with her back against the wall would normally do. Kev McCarthy, you tweeted about, is in Wyoming, coincidentally holding, doing a little fundraising on behalf of Liz Cheney's opponent. What does that tell you about the state of play out there? Is there any chance, in the face of all that we could be shocked tomorrow night by Liz Cheney, or this thing is now cooked? Stick a fork in it.
Right. On the shocked question, you know, Liz Cheney is relying on Democrats tomorrow to show up to their polling place, change their party registration from Democrat to Republican. But I was talking with a Hageman aide who said, look, even if every registered Democrat in the state, there's about 43,000 of them, switch your party registration tomorrow, they still don't think that'd be enough for Cheney to close the gap. That's how many Republicans are here in the state. As to Kevin McCarthy here and Liz Cheney, I think that's where having a conversation earlier with an aide to Cheney who noted that tomorrow's primary battle is just one of a much larger and longer fight that she intends to mount here to make sure that Donald Trump does not ever return to the White House. Liz Cheney is able to do that. She has a fundraising network. She's able to rake in millions of dollars. And while Kevin McCarthy coincidentally is holding a fundraising get-together for the NRSC, the Congressional Leadership Fund, the Super PAC, who is the right hand of his political operation here, well, they are here trying to build a Republican Party that is more into the shape and the image of Donald Trump, Liz Cheney has different intentions. What does that look like? A presidential run herself? That's a question mark here. And if she hasn't been able to convince her own neighbors in her own backyard here in Wyoming in 2022, could she do it in 2023, 2024? Well, if there's somebody that intends to try to do it, that's Liz Cheney.
Well, I correct myself there. McCarthy has done a fundraiser for Hageman in the past, not the one that he's doing up there in Jackson. Right this week, but he's worked on behalf of her opponent and has raised money for her. I ask you, Charlie Sykes, we go to the question about what her future holds. And it's an enormous question. The woman has a massive national profile now. She's not universally beloved. There are many Republicans who think she's a rhino who hate her, but there's also a bunch of people who don't like any other Republican who think she's doing something admirable. I want to read you this little Washington Post thing. Liz Cheney's political life is likely ending and just beginning. Cheney and a small but influential block of anti-Trump Republicans have decided that there must be a 2024 candidate who will run as an unabashed opponent of both the ex-president and other contenders who spew his mistruths about the 2020 election. Cheney and her crowd want a candidate who would serve merely as a political kamikaze, blowing up his or her candidacy, but also taking down Trump. So, I mean, the real question there, Charlie, is Liz Cheney that kamikaze?
She might be. Look, I mean, could we just comment on what an extraordinary woman Liz Cheney is in an era where we have discovered the political courage is vanishingly rare? She is this amazing profile and courage, and people should not underestimate this. Unlike so many others, she didn't run away from this fight. She did not self-exile. She had to know exactly what is going to happen to her in Wyoming and decided that standing up for the Constitution and pushing back against the anti-democratic forces in her own party was worth it. So she's also redefining this whole issue of relevance. I mean, you know, John, you talked to the same, you know, smart Republicans that, you know, you have to go along in order to stay relevant. Well, she's going to be defeated tomorrow, but she will be more relevant than ever. She will be more influential in defeat than she ever was when she was sitting in leadership. And that's going to be an extraordinary story. No, we have not heard the last of Liz Cheney. It has been a remarkable story. And I think it's going to continue because, quite frankly, she is so unusual, and there's something inspirational about that.
Vaughn Hillier, live from Wyoming. Can you, Vaughn, what is that behind you? What tree is that behind you? That's an incredible looking tree. It's like I've never recognized that tree before. What is that? Is that elkhorns? Is that a tree made out of elkhorns?
You're putting. I'm a botanist here in Wyoming. Is that what you're putting me on the spot with, John? Here.
Hey, man, I'm just asking.
How about you come out to town, all right, over the weekend, and then we can go explore together.
I'm just like, do a little reporting there, man.
Are you talking about these? Are you talking about the elkhorns?
Those elkhorns. That's elkhorns.
Are you talking about this?
Yeah. That's okay. What I'm talking about.
So every winter, just in the valley, just down the way here, there's the elk refuge, and the elk, they lose their horns. I'm getting this right, guys, right? They lose their horns, and then the local Boy Scout and Cub Scout troops, they come and pick up these elk horns, and then they ultimately construct them into things like this. But then they also go and give them out around the community. It's kind of a cool trait of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. For anybody that's never been here, it's my favorite place in America for what it's worth. So,
Vaughn, I'll just point out that although you mocked me a moment ago, you knew the story, and it was a heartwarming story, and I'm glad to have had it. So there you go. As I said, Vaughn Hillier.
I thought you were talking about that tree behind those. I'm sorry, John.
No. Good to see you, man. We'll talk to you again tomorrow, I'm sure. Charlie Sykes, great to have you on. Thank you, too. Ahead for us, new details about what may have motivated the suspect in the stabbing attack against celebrated and Marked for Death author Salman Rushdie.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Some encouraging news today on a truly terrible story that broke on Friday related to author Salman Rushdie of the Satanic Verses and The Ground Beneath Our Feet and so many other great books, Midnight's Children. He was stabbed several times at a talk he was giving last Friday in Chautauqua, New York. Rushdie has been taken off a ventilator and starting to heal from his injuries, according to his agent, Andrew Wiley. Since the attack, we've learned more about Rushdie's assailant from law enforcement. The 24-year-old suspect was charged with second-degree attempted murder on Saturday and entered a plea of not guilty. Prosecutors say that the attack on Rushdie was premeditated and targeted and that the suspect traveled by bus to Friday's event. Joining us now, Suzanne Nossel, CEO of PEN America, well-known advocacy group on behalf of free expression around the world. Suzanne has known Salman Rushdie for over a decade. Rushdie also formerly served as the organization's president. Suzanne, it's obviously good news that Salman Rushdie has survived. It sounds, though, like his injuries are pretty severe. Give us a sense of how his family is coping with what's happening right now and how the literary community around the world, which has always almost always rallied to Rushdie's defense in the face of the fatwa over the course of the last 30 years, what kind of response you're hearing within PEN?
Sure. Look, I think the family is showing a lot of courage. They are with him, supporting him, I'm sure sustaining his spirits at this time and communicating with the outside world. There are so many who are standing on vigil as he struggles through to recover from this. I would say for the literary community, you know, it's just a sense of shock and horror and a recognition that the threats that we've been talking about and addressing all over the world, you know, in Iran, in China, in Russia, in Turkey, also manifest right here in the United States on our own doorstep. And, you know, that's hard to come to grips with, but we have no choice.
Suzanne, we talk about the suspect here. You know, on Friday when this news broke, I'm old enough to remember when the fatwa was really in full effect and Rushdie was in hiding. People kept saying, well, we don't know what the motivation here is on this attacker. I've been to Chautauqua. Somebody goes up to Chautauqua and attacks Salman Rushdie. It's pretty likely that person's been motivated by the fatwa. Now we know that what's written here, a lone actor, this is from NBC News, lone actor inspired by extremism. Two law enforcement officials briefed on the case said the leading theory is that Matar, that's the accused, was a lone actor inspired by Iran-related extremism. The official stressed, however, that still early in the investigation, the suspect lived in the basement or lower level of a home in New Jersey where there was an Iranian flag flying in his living space, the officials said. We then later find out that Iran, well, let's look at that real quick, is celebrating the attack. The first public comment since the assault, Tehran denied any involvement but sought to justify the attack, which has been celebrated on front pages and its coverage across the country's media. We do not consider anyone other than him and his supporters worthy of blame or even condemnation, said the Iranian foreign ministry spokesman. He's basically blaming Rushdie for what happened to him. Is it clear to you, as clear as it is to me, that although Iran said they no longer were enforcing the fatwa, it's still the case that I believe it's a $3.3 million bounty on Rushdie's head, that this is where we're headed here. And on the basis of what we know, all signs point towards someone who is still trying to claim that reward.
I think it's hard to fathom, given even the limited information we have about this suspect, that the motive was related to the fatwa. Whether the Iranian government was involved, I mean, they've denied that. And yet we know the Iranian government has been active targeting other writers here on U.S. soil. There are a couple of other writers who have been subject to plots that have been revealed publicly over the last year and a half. They're Iranian American, so it's slightly of Iranian origin, so slightly different. But I definitely don't think anything can be ruled out at this point. We know that the Iranian government has operations and capacity here in the United States. You know, and this individual, what we, the limited information we have about his contacts and ties and allegiances suggests that this is a continuation of a war that was declared back in 1989. And, you know, finally somebody got to the edge of fulfilling that horrific, dastardly aspiration of silencing Salman Rushdie.
He made the decision after a period of time that he was just going to live his life in the open, and that was that hiding was not the way to live. And he, New York City, you see him all the time without security out in the streets and restaurants and other places. He's been very courageous in doing it, but he always said that he thought at some point someone would get to him. You wrote in The Guardian an op-ed about Rushdie. I want to read a little bit of that. You say Salman Rushdie has devoted his life to the freedom to write, exercising it, fighting for it, and using his fame and influence as a bulwark for all those who do the same. The attack on Rushdie is an attack on all who treasure the right to think, write, and speak freely. We owe it to him to recognize it as such. And it reminded me, reading that column reminded me of, you know, of Rushdie's great friend, Christopher Hitchens, who defended him so stalwartly at the height of the fatwa, who wrote, we'll always remember, he defends Salman Rushdie because it's a matter of everything I hate versus everything I love. In the hate column, dictatorship, religion, stupidity, demagogy, censorship, bullying, and intimidation. In the love column, literature, irony, humor, the individual, and the defense of free expression. That is what this man has meant to the literary community and the world for all these many years. And it is terrible what's happened to him, but also you must take some heart in the fact that it looks like he is in fact going to survive.
No, we do. I mean, we are celebrating our 100th anniversary this year as Pen America, our centenary. And so there's sort of something quite remarkable in you know, this attack on Salman is a crucible of both the perils that writers face and the tenacity and solidarity that defenders of free expression feel, where we really do come together in such a forceful way. And you know, we are not going to let this silence Salman's voice or the voice of any other writers. And I think this is only going to redouble the energy to combat threats against free expression and the freedom to write coming from all sides. And so, you know, in a sense, this is, I think, going to be a burst of energy that's going to fuel us into our next 100 years.
Suzanne Nossel, Pen America, Pen International, these are commendable, in fact, essential organizations. Anybody out there who wants to put some money towards a really good cause, send those guys a check, because they are fighting the good fight on behalf of free expression for all of us. Suzanne Nossel, as I said, thank you for spending some time with us. A quick break. We'll be right back. And finally, an update on that persecuted, beleaguered WNBA star, Brittany Griner. Griner's defense team filed an appeal today against her bogus conviction on drug charges in Russia. Griner was sentenced 2 weeks ago to 9 years in jail after authorities found cannabis vape cartridges in her luggage at an airport. It's ridiculous. The motion was widely expected, as it would keep Griner from going to a penal colony as part of her sentence. All of this comes as Russia has recognized prisoner swap talks with the United States for the first time publicly. A spokesman for Russia's foreign ministry said that, quote, quiet diplomacy is continuing as the two nations discuss a swap that reportedly would include Griner and jailed American Paul Whelan in exchange for convicted Russian arms dealer Victor Boot. Thank you for being with us this Monday.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.